Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches, but there aren't, right?
Right, because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at carvana.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hello and welcome to the Back to Movement podcast. I'm your host, Bernadette Goji, and this show features everything you need to know about back pain, fitness, wellness, and movement science. It is evidence-based and bringing you the latest scientific research along with expert tips. And my mission here is to help you achieve a healthy back, leading you to a life full of vitality with freedom of movement. And if you've been struggling with sleep and you need some tips and advice, then this episode is definitely for you, because we are going to talk about sleep with a very special guest. It is an absolute honor to introduce you to Dr. Nishi Bhopa, and she is a triple board certified physician with advanced training in sleep medicine and psychiatry. She is specializing in holistic approaches to sleep disorders. And she is here to share with us how you can actually sleep better, right? So please help me welcome Dr. Bhopa to the Back to Movement podcast. And Dr. Bhopa, can you please tell us what was your inspiration for studying sleep medicine?
Yes, well, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. And I think this is such a great topic because sleep and pain go hand in hand. So we're going to talk about that. But how I got interested in sleep medicine was for a couple of reasons. One was for my own personal reasons, and then also professionally. So personally, I was always someone who struggled with fatigue, feeling sleepy a lot of the time, and not really knowing how to get a handle on it. I felt like no matter how much sleep I was getting, I was still tired. And this was true for me when I was a child, as an adolescent, and then of course, when I was a young adult going through medical training, that became very, very challenging for me. So I had that own personal interest and experience in it. Professionally, I, you know, was going through my internal medicine training at first, and then I switched into psychiatry, and I was just seeing how sleep issues were so fundamental to the issues that my patients were struggling with, whether it was physical health problems or especially in psychiatry, mental health issues, issues with anxiety and depression. And we know there's a bi-directional relationship between mental health and sleep issues. So I just got really interested to learn more and to understand how I could better support my patients and also learn what was going on with me personally. So that's kind of how I embarked into this journey into sleep medicine.
Thank you for sharing this with us. And how common are sleep problems?
Sleep issues are incredibly common. In fact, they're so common that the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in the United States, have declared that sleep deprivation is a public health epidemic, because 1 in 3 adults in the United States, which is where I'm based, struggles with some form of insufficient sleep. And then you can break that down into other categories. So there's sleep disorders like insomnia, and about 30 8% of people experience some form of sleep difficulty from time to time, but 20% of adults experience some form of short-term insomnia at some period in their lives, and then about 10% of people have chronic issues with insomnia. And these numbers may actually be higher because people may not be reporting that they're experiencing these things, because many of us learn just to live with bad sleep, right? So the numbers might actually be higher than this. But we know at least a third of the population is dealing with some kind of sleep deprivation or sleep insufficiency.
Thank you. And what is insomnia? So what's the difference between, you know, someone cannot sleep or insomnia, or what's the relationship?
Yes, that's such a great question. So it's normal to have sleep difficulties from time to time, right? So I think that's really important for people to recognize that you're not going to get, you know, a perfect night of sleep every single night. That actually does not exist. So it's normal to have times where you might have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep because maybe there's some external stressor going on, or maybe it's because of excitement. You know, you have a big trip coming up or something like this. So that's normal. Yeah. But when it becomes insomnia, is especially chronic insomnia, is when people start to have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep for at least 3 nights a week for 3 months or longer. So that's the definition of chronic insomnia. So that's the point where, you know, people really should be thinking about getting support for it, because the good news about sleep issues is that they're highly treatable. And I even recommend, don't even wait for 3 months. You know, if you're struggling with sleep and it's becoming an issue for you, there is help available, right? So don't wait for 3 months or wait till, you know, you've tried everything, quote unquote, everything that you can try, because there's actually a very systematic way to address sleep issues, and the help is available. So for anyone listening who's struggling with sleep, go and see a sleep doctor.
That's, we can talk news. More about
that as well. Yes.
That's great. Thank you. How much should we sleep?
Yeah, so it's such an interesting question, because the general consensus is most adults need somewhere between 7 to 9 hours of sleep most nights to be rested. Right. And I say it's an interesting question because I was actually just on a platform a few weeks ago, and we were talking about meditation and sleep. So mm-hmm. for people who are advanced meditators, their sleep needs might actually decrease. So I'm talking about people like monks, you know, they're living up in the Himalayas or living in an ashram. So that's not most of us. But for most yes. of us as adults, we need somewhere between 7 to 9 hours of sleep most nights, and your sleep needs will be different. So your sleep needs may be different from my baseline sleep needs. It's like your shoe size, right? So maybe someone wears size 7.5, someone else wears a size 8, right? So sleep is like this. So your own baseline sleep needs will be individual for you.
Yes, thank you. And how would you describe the biological clock or circadian rhythm? And why is it so important?
So you can think about the biological clock as kind of like your master clock that tells your body when it's time to do things. Okay, so we have a master clock that's in the brain, in the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the brain, and that tells all of our other clocks in the body. So we've got clocks all over in our different organs, like in the liver and so on. So the master clock tells all the other clocks when it's supposed to do things. So what I mean by that is it'll tell your body when to raise and lower your core body temperature, when to release certain hormones like thyroid hormone or your hunger hormones. It'll tell you when you're supposed to be most alert and awake and when you're supposed to be sleepy. It controls your melatonin secretion, cortisol secretion, your blood pressure fluctuations, and so on. So this master clock is like a train station, and then you've got all these other trains that are running on a schedule, right? So you think about, you've got your blood pressure train, your thyroid train, all of these different things are running in, you know, on a certain schedule. But what happens is when your body clock is not running on a schedule, then it can lead to downstream health issues. So people can start to struggle with things like feeling fatigued, they feel tired, they might start having metabolic issues, you might start seeing things like prediabetes or high cholesterol, or people might start to experience more pain, which we're going to talk about. So when your body clock is disrupted, everything else becomes disrupted. But again, the good news is that there are very simple ways to get your body clock back on track. And this involves being really regular with your schedule, getting regular light and dark exposure at certain times, eating your meals at regular times, and so on. And I think we'll go in later and talk a little bit more about some specific sleep tips around that.
Yes, thank you. It's really interesting you said about, you know, lights, because I lived in Sweden for 2 years. And let me tell you, I was struggling at summer because the sun literally doesn't go down. And I had trouble sleeping there between May and September. It was terrible. I didn't know what to do. So they prescribed me melatonin, which kind of like helped me. I hate to take anything, you know, I really don't like to take any medication, but I was like, I need to sleep. So I took melatonin. So is it a good supplement? Is it even a supplement, or how would you describe it?
Yeah. So melatonin is both a supplement and it's also something that our body produces. So melatonin is a hormone that is produced in the body. It's produced in the pineal gland in the brain, and it's also produced in the gut. And it's involved in a number of different physiological processes in the body. So it helps to regulate the sleep-wake cycles. So that's why you were prescribed it. When you're exposed to light all the time, your brain's not going to produce its own melatonin, right? Because light inhibits melatonin. Yeah. But it also has anti-inflammatory effects. It has antioxidant effects. And so for people who are struggling with chronic pain, especially things like fibromyalgia, there's actually some data showing that taking melatonin supplements can reduce the inflammation associated with that pain and can also restore their sleep-wake cycles. So that's kind of an interesting connection there. However, when it comes to taking a melatonin supplement, quality matters. Because if you just grab a melatonin supplement off the shelf, which is available here in the United States, it's not available in every country over the counter, quality control is just not there, right? So I recommend looking for a third-party tested supplement. The dosing matters. There's different dosing strategies depending on what you're using it for, what kind of sleep issue or inflammatory issue. And the timing also makes a big difference, right? So taking it at the wrong time can actually sometimes throw your body clock out of whack a little bit more. So for people who are struggling with, you know, body clock issues, it's a good idea to talk to a sleep specialist who understands how to time the melatonin appropriately.
Thank you. I also use melatonin when I travel, you know, long distance travel, like to Australia or even the United States. Now I'm in Europe. And it does help me, especially to kind of like, you know, when you're working on your jet lag. So I take melatonin, so I stay awake, like I arrive in the morning to my destination and it's not, you know, I shouldn't go to sleep. Then I stay awake and then I take one melatonin. I have a really good night's sleep. And literally the next morning, the next day, I'm fine. I feel really, really good.
It's so interesting. It's such a powerful thing, right, with melatonin. And, you know, even small doses of it, even 0.5 milligrams, 0.3 milligrams can be really helpful. And I like that you mentioned this because melatonin is really a body clock regulator. You know,
this podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
So I'll see patients who they think of it as a sleep aid, but it's really not a sleep aid. It's actually something that regulates that body clock or the circadian rhythm. And for jet lag, there's also a wonderful app. I'm not affiliated with them, but I recommend it to my patients. It's called Time Shifter. And it'll tell you how to use melatonin and how to shift your body clock when you're traveling across time zones. So that's something that people can use. So you don't have to go and, you know, schedule an appointment with a sleep doctor if you don't have access to that and you're traveling. This is a great app called Time Shifter that you can consider trying.
Wow, that's great. Thank you for recommending that. So what do you, when you see a patient for the first time, how does it work with you?
Yeah, so it depends. Yeah, so it depends on, you know, what they're coming to see me for. They may be coming to see me for sleep issues, or they may be coming to see me for anxiety or depression, right? Because I'm a psychiatrist as well. So, you know, I have a practice, it's called Pacific Integrative Psychiatry. And our approach is really to provide a whole body approach to mental health and to sleep. Because one of the issues that I often see happening is that the underlying causes are not necessarily being addressed, whether someone's dealing with, you know, insomnia or some other sleep issue or anxiety. So the first step is really to see what's going on. Let's look under the hood to see what's happening. And this could include doing blood work. We do a full comprehensive, you know, history, medical history and assessment to see, you know, all the different pieces that might be contributing. And it's also about looking for other underlying sleep disorders that might be there. Because with insomnia, it may show up as insomnia, but underneath, people may have things like obstructive sleep apnea, or restless leg syndrome, or circadian rhythm disorder, like we were just talking about, right? So we really want to look under the hood to see what's going on, and then start addressing those root causes using a holistic approach.
Wow, it's very, very interesting. Wow. We don't even think how important is sleeping, I think. We just don't think how important it is. And it is very important to function. Because, example, if I have a bad night's sleep, I know the next morning I get up and my exercise isn't the same. I don't feel the same. I feel groggy. I don't feel good in my body. And I feel like I need to take a nap during the day when I don't feel good. And let's touch base on naps. You know, are naps good? When, of course, I had a newborn baby, I had to take a nap during the day. But even now and then, I like to take my nap. So let's see what you say about naps.
Yes. So, I am a huge fan of naps, and I think naps can be very restorative, and actually the data does support this. However, I'll put the caveat around it that for someone who is struggling with insomnia, it is not recommended to take a nap. Because when a person's struggling with insomnia, having a nap is like having a big snack before dinner. You're not going to be hungry when dinner time comes around. So a nap with insomnia is like that. It's like having your big snack and then you're not hungry for sleep at night. Okay. So for insomnia, no naps. However, for people who don't have insomnia, naps can be incredibly restorative. And actually, the data shows that a power nap, so this means, you know, 10, 20, less than 30 minutes before 3 p.m., can help you with your cognition. It can help you with your energy levels. It can help you with memory. So if you're trying to learn something, maybe you're studying something and you want to remember that information, a nap is going to help you consolidate that information. For me, I love a good power nap in the afternoon, especially if I'm kind of, you know, feeling a little dragging. You know, there's a natural dip in our circadian rhythm in the afternoon. That's why some cultures have a siesta built in.
Yeah. Yep.
So that's the power nap. Even companies like Google, NASA, Ben and Jerry's, they all have nap rooms built into their companies and their workforces, not because they want their employees, you know, sleeping on the job, but because they know how important naps are for productivity, right? So that's how restorative naps can be. There are other reasons to take naps. Like you mentioned, you know, if you're sleep deprived, you have got a young child at home that you're taking care of, you might need a nap to kind of, you know, restore yourself. Or if you've been sick, you know, if you've had COVID or something like this, you might need a 2 or 3 hour nap, right? So that's a different scenario. But most of the time, you want to keep it to less than 30 minutes.
Yes, I realize that every time I have a fever, I just cannot get out of bed. But that's natural, right? Because your body is fighting off a virus, infection, bacteria. So that's a different story. When I'm stressed, of course, you mentioned that before, that it affects how we sleep. You know, falling asleep, it's harder. So can you explain a little bit more, how does stress and anxiety affect sleep and sleep quality?
Yeah, so, you know, the two of them go hand in hand. So when people are struggling with stress or anxiety, it's going to be harder to sleep, and vice versa. When people aren't sleeping well, they have higher rates of stress and anxiety. And what happens is, you know, this is how I explain it to my patients, is that when you're dealing with anxiety, your body is in a fight or flight state, right? Your sympathetic nervous system is activated. So your body senses that you're in a sense of, in a state of danger. So of course you're not going to sleep, right? So understanding that your body's doing what it's supposed to do, your nervous system is doing what it's supposed to do. And sometimes even just having that mindset shift of like, oh, okay, my nervous system is working, that's why I can't sleep. That can sometimes take the anxiety out of the inability to sleep, right? Because what happens is people try to fight that. So even just recognizing that is the first step. The other way, though, when people aren't getting good quality sleep, is what happens is the prefrontal cortex, which is the rational decision-making part of the brain, it starts to quiet down. It's like the volume is turned down. And then the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that's involved in fear and emotional responses, the volume gets turned up. So then this is why if you don't get enough sleep, you start to feel irritable. You might be snapping at your partner. You might find that it's hard to stop worrying, right? You start feeling more stressed out about every little thing. Everything's getting on your nerves. So that's the relationship there. And actually, studies have shown that one night of good sleep can actually reduce anxiety levels by about 80% the next day.
Wow.
Yeah. So there is that strong correlation between the two.
Wow. That's good news. So what do you suggest if you are just tossing and turning? Like you go to bed at 9 p.m. and you just cannot fall asleep, and it's 11 p.m. You're checking the time. Oh my God, I have to get up in the morning. I have a big meeting. I cannot fall asleep. This melatonin didn't work. Then what should we do?
Such a common issue. I'm glad that you asked that. So what the first thing to do is don't get into bed until you're sleepy. Okay, so this is called sleep restriction or sleep compression, where we're actually restricting our time in bed so that the time you're in bed, you're mostly just asleep. Because what happens is when you're tossing and turning in your bed or you're worrying in the bed, it trains your brain to do that when you get into bed. So it becomes a habituated response. So we want to break that response by not getting into bed until you're sleepy. So that might mean you don't get into bed until midnight if you're not sleepy until midnight. Okay. Yeah. The second thing is that, you know, if you find that your mind is racing and you start to worry about sleep, oh my gosh, I'm not going to get enough sleep tonight. I'm going to be wrecked tomorrow. How am I going to get through the day? We want to start reframing those thoughts. So think about a time where you were sleep deprived and you were still able to function, right? More often than not, if you think back, you'll realize, yeah, I got horrible sleep that, you know, I'm thinking about a time when I was in med school and I went to med school in Ireland and I was so jet lagged and I couldn't sleep. And I still went to the hospital at, you know, 6 a.m. and did my thing and it was fine. You know, I wasn't as on as I should have been or could have been if I slept. But, you know, so think about times like that where, okay, yeah, I've gotten through it before. I can get through it again, right? So just that can help you calm down so you're not worrying like, oh my God, tomorrow's going to be so horrible. Yeah, you might not have as much energy as normal, but you'll be able to get through it. Then the next thing is to shift the focus away from trying to sleep to shifting to relaxation. Because mm-hmm. the more you try to sleep, the harder it becomes. You can't force it. It's like hunger again. If you're not hungry, you can't force yourself to eat and be hungry. Right? So sleep is like this. So you want to shift your attention from trying to get sleep to let me just relax. Let me watch this movie or read a book or take a bath or whatever it is that you find relaxing. Not because you heard it's supposed to help you relax, but you genuinely enjoy doing it and it's going to calm your nervous system.
It's very interesting that you said watch a TV because they say don't watch TV, but my mother... Thanks, Mom, if you're listening to this, but I have to share this. So she needs to switch on the TV no matter what happens. When she goes to her bedroom, she needs to switch on the TV for at least 10 minutes and she falls asleep. But if she doesn't do that, she has trouble falling asleep. But they say TV is not good. So then what's the answer?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a great thing to talk about because this idea that blue light and screens negatively impact sleep It has really taken hold in popular culture, but the science doesn't actually support that. And so for anyone who's interested in taking a deeper dive, I recommend listening to Dr. Michael Gradisar. He did a podcast interview with Matthew Walker, who wrote Why We Sleep, and they did a deep dive into the science of blue light and sleep and how it actually doesn't have the impact on sleep that everybody thinks that it does. So go and check that out. However, so here's the thing with screens. It doesn't mean, okay, now you have free reign to go on your phone at night. No. Okay. So this is how to think about it. Is that, yes, you want to dim your light exposure in the evening. So looking at a really bright iPad close to your face, not a good idea. But if there are certain things that help you calm down, so if watching a television show helps you calm your mind, and gets your mind off of things, that's okay. If there's a movie or something that helps you relax, that's totally fine. And TV is a little bit more passive as well, because you're not sitting and scrolling through it. You're not looking at comments. You're not typing anything. You're not, you know, it's not your work email. So it's less stimulating to the brain. I put the caveat on this that this is not the time to go watch a true crime documentary or something.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
It's going to keep you awake, right?
Something easier. Something lighter.
Exactly. And maybe you've seen it before. So this is what I tell patients too, is maybe it's reruns of some show that you find relaxing. You've seen it before. You're not listening to see what's going to happen because it's, you know, you've experienced it before. So if it's relaxing to you, it's okay. Now, I'll put another caveat on this, is that you don't want it to become an association, right? Where, you know, now if you don't have access to that thing, you won't be able to sleep without it. So you have to be very careful about not creating that association, because life is unpredictable. What if you're traveling? What if you're camping? What if you're doing something else and you don't have access to your TV program, right? So we want to retrain your brain to be able to fall asleep without those things. But it's not that those things are necessarily always harmful.
That's really powerful. So then how do you train your brain to do that?
Yes. So, okay. So a few things that I recommend. So one is really reframing your relationship with sleep, right? So when we have this relationship with sleep of, you know, I'm a bad sleeper, or I can't sleep without my TV show, or I can't sleep without my magnesium supplement, or whatever it is, right? When we start having those kinds of thoughts, it has a negative impact on our sleep quality. So just becoming aware of, you know, what's our relationship with sleep? What's our relationship with the bed? You know, I'll hear people say that they fall asleep on the couch, but they get into bed and now they're wide awake because the brain has developed an association of being awake in the bed, right? So just start to notice, what are those associations and thoughts that you have? The second thing is to really look at your whole structure of the day, because good sleep really starts during the day. What you do first thing in the morning is going to set you up for your sleep at night. So what I mean by this is a consistent wake-up time. That's one of the best things you can do for your sleep and your body clock, your circadian rhythm. Get bright light in the morning. If you're going through the day stressed out, you're going from one meeting to another, you're doing emails all day, you're running around after your kids, you're, you know, doing all kinds of things, your nervous system doesn't just turn off like a switch and go to sleep at night, right? So we have to create breaks, time for rest during the day, so your nervous system can regulate itself. And then by the time nighttime comes around, you're already kind of coasting into sleep, right? It's not an on-off switch. It's like a dimmer switch. So we want to activate those systems. And then the other thing is to spend less time in bed. And this is one of the big mistakes that I see people making, and it sounds so counterintuitive. Well, I need to get more sleep, so I should spend more time in bed. But what happens is it reduces your sleep efficiency. Sleep efficiency is how much you're sleeping in the bed. So actually cutting down the amount of time you're spending in bed is actually going to consolidate your sleep. So it's going to make it easier for you to fall asleep and reduce any nighttime awakenings. Now, having said all that, let's say you've tried all of these things and it's still not working and you're still not sleeping well. That's the point. It's worth going to talk to a sleep specialist.
Thank you. All right. So the bed is literally only for sleeping and some adult time. But question, what if someone has a TV in their bedroom? I don't, because we have our reasons. I find it that if I watch TV in bed, then I struggle falling asleep. But that's just me. But is it okay to have a TV in the bedroom, or you don't recommend it?
Yeah, you know, again, it really depends on the person. Generally, I don't recommend it, because what I see a lot of times happening is this thing called bedtime displacement. So now the person starts watching TV, even though they're kind of sleepy, now they're, you know, engaged in that, and then they're delaying their sleep onset. So generally, I don't recommend it. But again, you know, everyone is so different. And so, you know, for people who say, it helps me, it doesn't disrupt my sleep, they feel good, their sleep quality is good, okay, then that should be fine. But generally, yeah, better not to have it in the bedroom.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. So let's talk about the relationship between sleep and sleep deficiency and pain, chronic pain. Can you please tell us a little bit more about that?
Certainly. So what happens with insufficient sleep is that you become more sensitive to pain. So there's a phenomenon called hyperalgesia, where you just become more sensitive to pain. Smaller stimuli are going to cause a pain response. Your pain threshold goes down. There's also some theories about inhibition of the natural pain signals. So we naturally have, you know, opioids that the body produces to reduce our sensation of pain. And there is some data showing that when people are sleep deprived, that system is impaired, right? So you're not producing enough of those endogenous opioids. And so you become more, you experience more heightened pain. But the other thing is that we were just talking about some of the psychological factors. So, you know, when you're sleep deprived, you get increased anxiety, increased depression. And we know that when people experience those things, their experience of pain increases as well. So there could be that mechanism at play. And then the other aspect that's really important is that sleep is a time of restoration and healing. So we get healing of the muscles and all the tissues. And so if you're not getting enough sleep, the body doesn't have time for that healing and repair and to reduce inflammation. And therefore, people can experience more pain.
Wow. Thank you. I would like to ask, you know, I have a Fitbit and I check my sleep the next morning because I'm interested. I can actually tell how I slept, because you get up in the morning and you actually can feel how you slept. But anyway, and then you can see REM and light sleep. You know, can you please explain a little bit more about those?
Yes. So we have different stages of sleep that we go through across the night. And this is called our sleep architecture. It follows a specific pattern across the night. And then we have different sleep cycles. So our sleep cycle is comprised of these different stages. So essentially, we've got stage 1, stage 2, stage 3. These are all non-REM sleep. And then we've got REM sleep, or rapid eye movement sleep. So with stages 1, 2, and 3, sleep gets progressively deeper. Stage 1 is our transitional stage, where you're kind of in between sleep and awake. Stage 2 is still a lighter stage of sleep, but it's going deeper into sleep. And then stage 3 is our deep sleep, right? So often what I see is people get deep sleep and REM sleep mixed up. They're two different stages. So there's a stage called deep sleep, and then there's a stage called REM sleep. And so they all have their own different functions. There's a certain proportion that we're looking for throughout the night. For an adult, about 5% of sleep is stage 1, about 50% is stage 2, about 20% is stage 3, and then about 25% is REM sleep. Okay, so with that in mind, also take your data from your wearable with a grain of salt. Because these wearables, and I have one too, I have an Aura ring. So, you know, whether you have an Aura ring or a Fitbit or a Whoop or whatever you're using, take it with a grain of salt because they're really not that accurate yet at estimating the sleep stages. Because how we measure sleep stages is with brainwave activity. We use an EEG in the sleep lab to tell what stage of sleep someone's in. As the technology evolves, we may be able to do this more accurately without that EEG. And there is some professional grade wearables that can be used by sleep doctors to do this. But if you're wearing a Fitbit or something, don't worry about the sleep stages because people will come to me and go, oh my God, I only got 7% REM sleep or, you know, something like that. Don't even worry about that. Like you said, how you feel is the most important metric.
Yeah, I realized that. Thank you. So I have clients with chronic low back pain because I'm a back pain coach and many, many of my clients have sleep issues. So I guess chronic low back pain or any chronic pain goes hand in hand with lack of sleep. So can you explain the connection between sleep and chronic pain?
Yes, absolutely. So what happens with, you know, sleep and pain, like we were talking about, you get, you know, enhanced pain signals and you get, enhanced inflammatory responses and things like this. But the other aspect that happens is when people aren't getting good quality sleep, it's harder for them to engage in the behaviors that are going to help them reduce the pain, right? So things like regular exercise, stretching, going out for, you know, sunshine, you know, going out for fresh air, things like this, or even healthy eating, because when people are sleep deprived, you start to crave more junk foods, right? Like I know when I'm sleep deprived, I start to crave chocolate and French fries, right? So, you know, when you're chronically sleep deprived, those are the types of foods that you want to eat, which then increases inflammation. So that's how, you know, all of these kind of systems interact with each other. But what's really interesting is, you know, I was doing some research on the, you know, impacts of different sleep interventions for chronic pain. And one of the interventions that we use for chronic insomnia is called CBTI or cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. So this is the most effective treatment that's available for chronic insomnia. It's the first line gold standard treatment. And they've actually shown that when people who have pain disorders, when they engage in CBTI for their insomnia, they get lower levels of inflammatory markers. So lower levels of things like CRP, interleukin-6, TNF, all of these markers of inflammation actually go down and pain symptoms decrease. Even though CBTI isn't specifically for pain, you see these significant benefits in pain disorders.
Wow. Yes, that's great. So sleeping is important, definitely. So how does regular exercise impact our sleep patterns and overall sleep quality then? Is it good for us, even though when we sleep deprived and we, you know, we don't feel really good and we don't feel like working out or do any physical activity because we are just so sleepy and tired? Should we actually try and engage in some form of physical activity? Is it going to help us to fall asleep or to sleep better?
So it's such a great point too, what you were just saying, you know, when you don't have the energy to exercise, could that actually be harmful, right? If you're overdoing it, are you going to like overextend yourself and hurt yourself more, especially if you have back pain?
Yeah.
So I like to reframe exercise to movement. So instead of thinking about, oh my God, I don't have the energy to go run on the treadmill or to go lift weights or whatever. Well, how can you get more movement into your day, right? And we do know that there are very positive benefits of movement on sleep. It increases the amount of time spent in that stage 3 deep sleep that we were talking about, which is the time for tissue healing and recovery. So we want to increase that, and exercise is a good way to do that. It also, exercise also increases the sleep drive, which is your sleep hunger, right? So at nighttime, you're going to be more hungry for sleep. It reduces the sleep latency or the time it takes to fall asleep, and it increases that sleep efficiency that we were talking about as well. So the amount of time you're actually asleep in your bed. So movement is, it's a natural antidepressant. as well, right? So the more movement you're getting, it's going to help your mood, it's going to release endorphins, and it's going to help reduce inflammation over time. So yes, very helpful, but just be mindful of what your limits are, right? So I see patients who have chronic fatigue disorders and fibromyalgia and things like this, and they're exhausted after they go for, you know, a 3-hour hike or something like that. So that might be too much. So it's really important to tune into your body and figure out what works for you.
Yes, perfect. Thank you. And what are the physiological mechanisms behind the relationship between exercise and improved sleep?
Yes. So one of them is related to thermoregulation, which is the body temperature. And when we were talking before about the circadian rhythm, one of the things that the body clock or circadian rhythm does is it controls our body temperature. And at night, in order to fall asleep, we need a reduction in our core body temperature by a couple of degrees in order to fall asleep. So what exercise does is it helps with that thermoregulation process. So you get an increase in your body temperature when you're exercising and just immediately afterwards. And then a few hours later, your body temperature starts to cool down, and that actually promotes sleepiness. So by regulating your body temperature, it's actually going to help with your circadian rhythm and your sleep onset. We also talked about the increased sleep efficiency and the deep sleep and some of the mechanisms with that. Exercise also does help to regulate the circadian rhythm because there's really three things that regulate our body clock. So we talked about light exposure. The other is the regularity of mealtimes. And then the third is the regularity of movement. So when you're getting movement around the same time every day, it strengthens your circadian drive, and that's going to help with your sleep regulation. And then, of course, the stress regulation. As a psychiatrist, movement is one of the best things you can do to discharge energy, especially if you have, you know, anxiety, you have stress, or you're feeling depressed and you're feeling the sense of inertia. Getting your body moving and discharging that energy is so, so therapeutic. And then it releases the endorphins that we were talking about as well. And then also, of course, it helps with insomnia, because with insomnia, one of the things that happens is a person's sleep drive decreases, or that sleep hunger decreases. And with exercise, you get an increase in a neurotransmitter called adenosine, which is a neurotransmitter that makes us feel sleepy. So the more movement and exercise you get, the more you build up your adenosine levels, and that's going to help you with sleep at night.
Wow, that's great. So we definitely need to exercise. It's good for us. I wanted to touch base on, you mentioned that something with our core temperature, it so the core temperature drops. That's what you mentioned. So is it possible this is why we need to sleep in a cooler room? Because at summer, when it's really hot, I can't fall asleep. I just toss and turn and just sweating. And I sleep better if the room temperature is cooler. So what do you recommend for the room temperature to be?
Yeah, that's exactly why we recommend a cooler room temperature, because of this necessity of body temperature decreasing for sleep onset. And one of the things that melatonin helps to do when we produce it endogenously is it helps to reduce the core body temperature, or at least it's associated with that. I think the mechanism needs to be understood more. Okay, so your ambient temperature in your bedroom, generally around somewhere between 65 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 18 degrees Celsius, in that range is what is recommended. But of course, it's going to be different for everybody. My husband likes the room to be freezing. So for me, it might not be helpful to have it that cold. So you have to, have him compromise a little bit too, but figure out what works for you, because 65 Fahrenheit for one person might be too cold for the next. But a couple things you can do. One is, what I like to do is actually open the windows in the bedroom before I go to bed, or, an hour or two. Yeah, and cool out the room.
So love it.
And then you air out the room too, which is nice. You get that fresh air. So you can do that, and then shut the windows if need be when you go to sleep. But the other thing that's helpful is to have a warm shower or bath before bed. And it sounds counterintuitive. Why should I have a warm shower and warm up my body if I need to cool down? And the reason that helps is because your warming up your external body, right? Your skin temperature increases, but then your core body temperature decreases. And especially when you come out of that warm shower or bath, you get this reduction in that core body temperature, and that can help with sleep onset.
So now you just explained why I love taking a hot bath before I go to bed. I cannot go to sleep. And I know I shouldn't say this. I should be even without having the hot tub. I should be able to go to sleep. But this is my thing. I have to have a hot bath before I go to sleep, because it helps me to sleep better, to kind of like relax in the hot, in the bathtub. And I just love it. So that's one thing. I cannot move to a place where there is no, a bathtub, because I just love it. Shower doesn't really work for me as well, because I like to just, stay in a little bit longer and enjoy myself. There is one thing that I really wanted to ask you. Why do we, and I'm not saying I am, but many of my patients get up at around 3 a.m. at night? Why is that? And they cannot fall, they just have a hard time falling back to sleep. And can you please explain why is that?
There's a few reasons for that. Okay, so one is that there's a natural awakening that happens around 2 or 3 in the morning, because especially if someone has gone to bed around, let's say 10 p.m. or, 11 p.m., if they've fallen asleep around that time, that's 4 or 5 hours later after their sleep onset. So it's natural to have these awakenings after each sleep cycle, which is about 90 to 120 minutes. And then it's more noticeable around that time because your sleep hunger has decreased by then. Right. So you've had, 4 or 5 hours of sleep already. So you've paid off most of your sleep debt for the day by then. Right. There's still some more sleep to go. So those awakenings are more noticeable at that time. This is also when people might get up and use the bathroom or something like this. But other things that can cause this: anxiety and stress. Right. So if there's something on your mind, you might start experiencing those awakenings. Blood sugar drops can also contribute to these. So if someone's eating their dinner too early in the evening, sometimes having a high fiber, high protein snack about an hour before bed can stabilize their blood sugar at night so that they're not having these prolonged awakenings. Sometimes hormonal issues, especially, for women, if they're in that perimenopausal, menopausal age group, that can happen. And then certain sleep disorders can also show up like this. For example, sleep apnea. So that might cause these awakenings because you're not breathing properly at night. And then those awakenings are more noticeable at that time. What I will say is that it is normal to wake up at night, because I think many of our patients, they have this idea, and no fault of their own. I mean, we all kind of grew up with this idea that you have to sleep for 8 hours straight. And maybe when you were a child, you did that, right? Or you were a young adult. And then now you're like, why am I waking up? So it's actually totally normal to wake up in the middle of the night. That in itself is not a problem. It only becomes a problem if those awakenings are prolonged and you're having, so when I say prolonged, I mean an hour, 2 hours or longer, and they're happening on a regular basis. That's when you want to look into some of those root causes that I just mentioned. But if you're having these awakenings and within 20 minutes or so, you're falling back asleep, your body's doing what it's supposed to do. That's totally normal.
Great news. Perfect. Thank you. And can you give 3 tips for people dealing with sleep problems so they can improve their sleep? So 3 to 5 tips, let's say that.
Number one is that good sleep starts during the day. So getting up at a consistent sleep time, or a consistent wake time rather, every single morning, getting bright light at that time is such a great way to regulate your body clock and improve your sleep quality. Our bodies crave consistency. If you have a pet, like I have a dog, he knows exactly when it's time to go for his walk, when it's time for his dinner. He's on a clock. And I think as humans, we've kind of lost touch with those innate instincts. Our bodies know when we're supposed to be doing different things. So getting back in touch with that, regulating your system is going to help with your sleep. Second thing is to spend less time in bed, as we've been discussing. Because the tendency is when someone's not sleeping well, okay, I'm going to spend more time in bed and hope I get more sleep. that actually creates more sleep fragmentation and it reduces sleep quality. So restricting the amount of time in bed closer to how much you're sleeping within reason. I'm not saying only spend 3 hours in bed or anything like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're sleeping like, you know, 7 hours, but you're in bed for 10 hours, that's not helping you. So you want to restrict closer to that seven and a half hours amount of time. And then if you've tried all these things and nothing is working and you're struggling, then you want to look for the root causes. So these are the things like, you know, chronic insomnia, obstructive sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome. Maybe there's a medical issue that's underpinning it, like a thyroid issue, gut health, nutritional deficiency. You know, maybe there's anxiety or depression that's not being addressed. So that's when you want to go and seek extra support.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. Bhopal. And thanks for everyone listening to the Back to Movement podcast with Dr. Nishi Bhopal and with me, your host, Bernadette Gaji. And I hope you enjoyed the podcast and all the insights you learned about how to sleep better. And this is all for this episode, and see you next time. Thank you.